Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're about to hear a recording of a live radio program. It's called Indivisible. You can listen live and call in four nights a week on public radio stations around the country or at indivisibleradio.com. You can also join the conversation with hashtag IndivisibleRadio or leave us a voicemail at indivisibleradio.com. Subscribe now so you don't miss a thing. Okay, here's the show.
This is Indivisible. Public Radio's national conversation about America in a time of change.
From WNYC in New York, I'm Charlie Sykes. This is Indivisible, Public Radio's live national call-in show for the first 100 days of the Trump administration. And yes, it is still in the first 100 days. And of course, because it is the era of Trump in the news this week, Russian spies, Susan Rice, social media lit up, the controversy about Kendall Jenner's Pepsi ad, which I'm not going to talk about tonight. But real life has a way of intervening. In Syria, a deadly chemical attack shocks the world. Now, this would be the same world that has said never again after the Holocaust, never again after Rwanda, but has basically turned a blind eye to what is happening in Syria right now. Of course, the North Koreans have fired another missile. Controversial presidential aide Steve Bannon was removed from the National Security Agency. And in Washington, the U.S. Senate moves closer to invoking the so-called nuclear option as they get ready to confirm Judge Neil Gorsuch to the U.S. Supreme Court. Meanwhile, President Trump picked a Twitter fight because, of course, well, that's what he does, with a House Freedom Caucus, and congressional Republicans seem to have a very hard time deciding whether they are ready to be a governing party or would rather form a circular firing squad. Now, on tonight's show, we have a very, very unusual show. We've got an all-Wisconsin lineup tonight, maybe because Wisconsin has become, you know, the center of the political universe for the last several years. Later this hour, we will be talking live with House Speaker Paul Ryan. And what I want to do is we're going to be asking you what questions I should ask him. And we're going to be doing that. We're going to open the phone lines up in about 10, 15 minutes. In the meantime, though, I want to introduce my first guest, Reed Ribble. Represented Wisconsin's 8th District for 6 years in the House. He was also a member of the House Freedom Caucus. And Congressman Ribble, welcome to Indivisible. How are you?
Hey, Charlie. I am doing good. It's so good to talk with you.
Well, by the way, happy birthday.
Well, thank you very much. I'm starting to feel old.
Yeah, well, that happens to all of us. Well, let's talk about, you know, what is going on in Washington. You know, you were there, a very, very close associate of Speaker Paul Ryan. You know how the House of Representatives works. You were a founding member of the Freedom Caucus. Am I right about that?
You are correct. I was. We started the Freedom Caucus my last term in Congress back in, I guess that would have been 2015, with the idea that we would offer conservative solutions to the House of Representatives and try to advance legislation from a conservative perspective. But over the course of time, it became obvious that it was more about stopping what we felt was not really good legislation rather than really advancing good legislation, which ultimately led to when I left the Freedom Caucus at the end of 2015.
Okay, so what made you quit the Freedom Caucus?
Well, ultimately, I opposed the idea of trying to oust John Boehner. And the reason is because I didn't think Boehner was the problem, and we're now seeing with the new speaker that Boehner wasn't the problem, that actually the members are the problem, that you don't really have a united Republican front, that it is not a conservative Congress, even though it is a Republican one. But the divisions within the Republican Party are so wide you couldn't find any type of way to move forward.
So Do Republicans have a governing majority in the House of Representatives right now?
Oh, no, and they haven't had it at all. I mean, and we saw that when they ousted Boehner, and then they weren't really going to support Paul. And I'm a good friend of Paul Ryan's. I'm a supporter of Paul Ryan's, and I felt he would make a good speaker, and I didn't think John Boehner was a bad speaker. But we do not have a governing majority in the House, and we didn't have one for the last 6 years.
Now, for our listeners who are not familiar with your track record, you were the first and perhaps the only member of the congressional delegation to announce that he was never Trump very, very early. I think that you came out in 2015. Was the rise of Donald Trump and what's happened to the Republican Party, was that one of the factors that contributed to your decision not to run for re-election?
No, it wasn't so much the rise of Trump. The number one factor was, is, and still is the fact that I wanted to spend more time with my grandchildren. I have a brand new grandson, just a month old here. But I will say this: there was an ever increasing frustration that I had with the process in which the House was running. And by that, I mean that there was too much of a top-down system. Members of Congress did not have enough say on legislation. And as a result of that, these factions that you're now seeing, and it really played out in the American Health Care Act, really come to the forefront. Instead of pulling the party together, the process was so bad that it pushed people apart.
Right, I'm going to get back to that in just a moment. There's a new Quinnipiac poll out showing that right now, President Trump's approval rating is below President Obama's worst poll rating ever when he bottomed out in 2013. Donald Trump in his first 100 days is already below that with a 35% approval rating, 57% disapprove. 61% say the president's not honest. 55% say he does not have good leadership skills. 57% said he does not care about average Americans. 66% say he is not level-headed. And the president right now is getting a negative 28% approval, 64% disapproval rating for the way that he is handling health care. As someone who was not a supporter, does any of this surprise you? Has it been better or worse than you expected? What do you think's going wrong?
No, I think that there's a couple of things that have gone wrong. First of all, President Trump is who he is, and I think from my perspective, Charlie, he kind of revealed himself during the campaign, and he's trying to govern from the White House in the same manner that he ran his campaign, and that was never going to be set up for success. Secondarily to that, in many respects, he didn't bring the very best people around him when he went into the White House. And by that, I mean, it's not that he has bad people. It's that he doesn't have anybody experienced in the ways of government. He does have some political people in there that are experienced in the ways of campaigning and winning elections, but he doesn't have anybody experienced in running government. And as a result of that, he's had a rough start. And until he gets some real high-quality people around him, but more importantly, until he's willing to listen to quality people around him, he's going to continue to struggle, I believe. And that's unfortunate for the country.
Let's go back to the health care issue, because we touched on it a little bit earlier. I will talk with Speaker Ryan later in the hour. All indications are that that the attempts to resurrect the failed bill have failed, and that there's not going to be either repeal or replacement any time soon. From your point of view, and you were one of the Republicans that ran repeatedly on we're going to get rid of Obamacare. What went wrong? What is going wrong? How did the Republicans manage to fail on their signature issue right out of the box?
In my perspective, and I'm not there, but I am watching it, paying attention, I think the process was all wrong. And when you don't get the process right, you make it very difficult to advance legislation. Members of Congress should never learn about key pieces of legislation in the media or from K Street. But what happened is this was written by committee chairman and the leadership. It was then tested with K Street and tested through the media to see what was going to happen. But members of Congress didn't get to see it. And what had to happen is ultimately the legislation should have been written. Members of Congress should have seen it first. The markups that took place in Ways and Means and Energy and Commerce should have allowed amendments so Republican members could perfect the bill and advance it. But you are trying to thread a very, very narrow gap here.
Let's just say that the process was perfect. Let's talk about the policy here. You know, historically, Republicans have never successfully repealed a middle class entitlement that's gone into effect. And so the first thing out of the box, you begin to hear that you're going to dismantle Obamacare, which now is a 55% approval rating. People become concerned that more people will lose coverage. Was it the process or was it the actual policy that maybe Americans, you know, might have told pollsters they didn't like it, but when a push came to shove, they didn't want to lose Obamacare?
Well, I think in part it was that. And I actually tweeted that day, stop looking at the people, meaning the members of Congress, start looking at the policy and the process, because that's when it went wrong. And it went wrong in two different places. It did go wrong in policy, and it did go wrong in process. And if you look at the policy, I think maybe what could have happened, because we did repeal Obamacare a year ago, and we got that repeal through the Senate and through the president's desk. What could have been done is on day one of the Trump administration, you could have had that repeal done. And the minute the repeal happens, it forces the minority party to the table in the replacement. But they tried to do this in a single piece of legislation, which left the Democrats out of it. Had they done the repeal immediately, just like they did in 2015, then Democrats had to come because the bill was going to end in 2 years or whatever. And so I think that was part of the problem.
Yeah, well, that, of course, is one of the questions. Having, I think the Republican House voted, 40, 50, 60 times to repeal Obamacare. But then you were firing blanks because you knew that was never going to get through the Senate. It was never going to be signed by the president. So now you have the very first opportunity to actually have it signed into law. And Republicans choked, didn't they?
They did. They did. I'm not saying it's Paul Ryan's fault or the Freedom Caucus fault or the Moderates' fault. The fact of the matter is that conference of nearly 240 Republicans could not find enough common ground on what they wanted to do. But that's why I go back to my statement. Maybe they were firing blanks in 2015 when we passed it to the House, passed it to the Senate, and then President Obama vetoed it. But the point is that that bill did get enough votes to have that happen. And had they repealed it first, then everybody has to come to the table with a fix.
I want to play for you an excerpt from an interview with Senator John McCain that was conducted by the senior editor of The Economist, Ann McElvoy, who's our Monday night Indivisible radio co-host. You can, by the way, hear the full interview tomorrow on The Economist radio podcast. I want to play for you just a short segment of what John McCain had to say about the nature of partisanship right now in Washington.
I feel the partisanship is at an all-time high. The anger and bitterness that characterized the results of the last presidential election has been attenuated and affected here. And there's, unfortunately, approval ratings of Congress are down around in the teens, and the approval rate of the president is in the 30s. So obviously Americans are not very happy with business as it's conducted here in our nation's capital.
So, Reid Ribble, do you agree with John McCain that partisanship is at an all-time high?
I do. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Part of it has to do with the civic discourse in this country, which you and I have spoken about before, Charlie, many times. The more incendiary our rhetoric gets, the more difficult it is to heal wounds, to pull people together. And so when people even have the ability of finding common ground, we've now damaged relationships so bad that you can't get there. And quite frankly, we have a more parliamentarian style of government in the Congress, which is driven more by political parties than it is by political ideas and solutions. And as a result of that, if it's all about holding the gavel and maintaining power, You force more of this partisanship on the country, and then you could also add gerrymandering of districts to that list.
You know, I know that when you were in Congress, occasionally you would look for areas of common ground, possibility of bipartisan cooperation. I had a very interesting talk with a Democrat earlier today who was explaining that there was just no way the Democrats were going to cooperate with Republicans going forward because the base, the Democratic base, will not allow that. And, of course, neither will the Republican base. That basically we have now perpetual outrage machines on both sides of the divide that even if you're a member of Congress and you want to find bipartisan solutions, you're faced with being beaten up. Was that your experience in trying to forge some sort of common ground?
Oh, it was. I mean, when I ran, I ran in 2010 during the big Tea Party wave, even though I didn't have a lot of support from Tea Parties in Wisconsin, I won in that environment. And the message I heard repeatedly when I came back to the district from conservatives was no compromise, no compromise, no compromise. When in fact our entire system is designed and developed and was set up by our founders to find compromise, and that if you couldn't find compromise, then you shouldn't move forward. And now what we have instead is one side lording it over the other. And so, and today we've got the exact opposite, where the hard left, the Bernie Sanders group, is now doing exactly what the Tea Party did in 2010.
I remember the last time we spoke, you were talking about how frustrating it was to be a member of Congress because there were so many voters who really would not accept anything other than 100%. That in this hyper-partisan world, that, I mean, it used to be that people said, okay, you know what, I'll settle for 80%, you know, or my friend that agrees with me 80% of the time is not my enemy. I think that was Ronald Reagan, correct?
Yeah,
did he say that?
That's right.
That seems like a completely different era now, doesn't it? Because if you're not 100%, you are a sellout. Did you experience that?
I did. I experienced it frequently. And I'm a fairly conservative guy like you, and I believe in principles and holding on to certain principles. But I also believe in the American ideal and this experiment and this great republic that we live in. And our founders had a lot of wisdom by forcing a system whereby we had to find agreement with the differences. The fights that we're facing today are as common as James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, and those in the early days experienced. And we're just reliving it 200 plus years later.
So what happens now, given all the stuff we now sort of, you know, set the table? But where does the Republican Congress go on the Trump budget, on tax reform, on things like the border adjustment tax or a $1 trillion infrastructure? Do you think that that's going to get done?
Well, it doesn't look very likely right now. I think I would agree with Paul Ryan. It's likely that the health care issue is dead for a while. When it comes to tax reform, I think that's going to be a very tough lift. The border adjustment tax is something that a lot of business people, including myself, would typically oppose. And if they try to move that through the Senate, it isn't going to touch it. I don't believe that there's enough votes in the Senate to pass it. They've got a lot of work to do, and there's some real soul searching. And even though I'm in a 1-year timer, I'm not supposed to be giving advice to members of Congress. I would say this to your listeners: the best thing that the Republicans in Congress could do is hit the pause button, go back to Baltimore or Philadelphia or wherever they went on their retreat, start over. And they've got to have some real soul searching with each other, and they've got to get everybody in the room and talk it out, figure out what they're going to do next, or it's going to be like this for 2 years.
Yeah, no, I agree with your analysis, by the way, which means that there's a very real possibility that we could go months and months and months into the Trump presidency without a single major piece of legislation passed. Is that possible, that we would get none of these things done?
I think so, because, I mean, the budget that the Trump administration sent over to the Congress is a virtual non-starter. Even the most conservative members of Congress wouldn't support it. And so I don't see that that's going to go anywhere. But presidents' budgets typically don't go anyplace. And so with absent a budget that they can get agreement on, it makes it difficult to do appropriations, and now you can't spend money. If you can't do appropriations in regular order, you can't change what the actual policy is, so you end up with another continuing resolution or omnibus spending bill. And it looks like they're off to a really rocky start. And I pray for Paul Ryan every single day because he's got his hands full.
Congressman Ribble, thanks so much for joining me. I appreciate it very much.
We'll
catch up when I'm back in town.
I look forward to seeing you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Reed. You know, one of the reasons why I wanted to talk with Reed Ribble, Ribble is one of the kinds of guys that we all, when we talk about who do we want in politics, what kind of a person do we want to, you know, in their values and their demeanor and their intelligence, he was really one of them. But he's also one of the kinds of guys that is, I think, being pushed out in a certain way. Congressman Ribble represented Wisconsin's 8th District for 6 years. You're listening to Indivisible Public Radio's National Conversation about America in a Time of Change. I'm Charlie Sykes. Okay, when we come back, we're going to set up what we're going to do later in the program. I'm going to be talking with Speaker Paul Ryan, and I want to hear from you what you would like me to ask him. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Indivisible is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes, pre-selected portions, and fresh ingredients to customers' doors. More at blueapron.com/indivisible.
Amber Ruffin has been a black writer in mostly white spaces for much of her career. But her success has led to opportunities to make her own spaces and make them as black as she wants.
Nothing feels better than being like, which Babyface song? Not that one, the other one. It's the feeling of writing without weights.
I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America for a conversation with comedian Amber Ruffin. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Indivisible. The number to call is 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-8255.
This is Charlie Sykes from WNYC in New York. A little bit later in the program, I'm going to be talking with Speaker Paul Ryan. And we wanted to give you listeners the opportunity to help us set the agenda for that conversation. We want to let's do it this way. I just want one sentence question, one sentence that you would, if you had a chance to talk with the Speaker of the House of Representatives live, what would you ask him? I'm not looking for a monologue, not looking for a speech. One question, and maybe we'll have time to be able to do that. Now, our number is 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-8255. You can also tweet your question to us with the hashtag IndivisibleRadio. And I want to set it up this way. People need to put it in a little bit of context here. I mean, I have known Paul Ryan. I think people probably have figured out right now that I'm a Wisconsin guy. I figured out over the last 10 weeks that I am a Wisconsin guy. I've known Paul Ryan for probably more than 20 years now. I have interviewed him dozens and dozens of times, but I think this is going to be difficult, different. It will be difficult, too. Different because, obviously, this is a different audience, and it's a different format, and I want to have a different approach. I'm somebody that has, in the past, been very supportive of a lot of the things that Paul Ryan did, although he and I obviously went in different directions last year. He made the decision at a certain point that he was going to go with the party nominee. I never made that pivot. So understand where I come from, that I've known Paul Ryan for a very, very long time, but I also want to ask him questions that might be very different from the kinds of questions that he would get, say, on Fox News or conservative talk radio, where I used to be. And also, I think it's legitimate just to raise the question of, you know, why, you know, how he has changed his position. How has he handled this evolution? We can get into the policy. There's no question about it. We're gonna go to your calls in just a second. We can get into the policy, but also, you know, I want to be able to discuss, or at least to touch on, how the Paul Ryan from 1 year ago became the Paul Ryan today. Now, today, by the way, I think I told you this. I was talking to my producer that 1 year ago today was the Wisconsin Republican primary. You might remember that. I certainly remember that, where people thought that Wisconsin was going to become the firewall of rationality for the Republican Party. Instead, it turned out to be a relatively minor speed bump. But there was a very, very clear position by a lot of Republicans in Wisconsin, including Paul Ryan, that has obviously, evolved. I mean, let's go back. Let's play a couple of these sound bites. Ryan was among leading Republicans probably the most, or certainly one of the most, outspoken critics of then-candidate Trump. Let's just play this from June 7th, 2017, when he's responding to what then-Republican candidate Trump had said about a Mexican-American judge.
I disavow these requirements. I regret those comments that he made. I don't think claiming a person can't do their job because of their race is sort of like the textbook definition of a racist comment. I think that should be absolutely disavowed. It's absolutely unacceptable. But do I believe that Hillary Clinton is the answer? No, I do not. Do I believe that Hillary Clinton is going to be the answer to solving these problems? I do not. I believe that we have more common ground on the policy issues of the day, and we have more likelihood of getting our policies enacted with him than we do with her. But I do absolutely disavow those comments. I think they're wrong. I don't think they're right-headed. And the thinking behind it is something I don't even personally relate to.
And then, of course, there was the Access Hollywood video in October. And very shortly after that, Paul Ryan had a conference call with his fellow Republicans. This would have been middle of October. This is a call with House members. This was published, leaked more recently by Breitbart, Breitbart.com in March. This is what the speaker had to say. This was less than a month before the election.
His comments are not anywhere in keeping with our party's principles and values. There are basically two things that I want to make really clear. As for myself as your speaker, I am not going to defend Donald Trump. Not now, not in the future. As you probably heard, I disinvited him from my first congressional district GOP event this weekend, a thing I do every year. And I'm not going to be campaigning with him over the next 30 days. Look, you guys know I have real concerns with our nominee. I hope you appreciate that I'm doing what I think is best for you, the members, not what's best for me.
Okay, let's go to the calls. If you had a question, ask him. And again, there's really no limitation. We'll be talking with him in the next half hour. Give us a call at 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-8255. And we'll start off with just one sentence. If we want to expand it, I'll ask you, but you have to have just one sentence. That is the rule. Let's go to Robert from Bethel, Vermont. You are an Indivisible. Good evening. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for taking my call. Back when the Speaker of the House resigned, the Republicans had to beg Mr. Ryan to become Speaker of the House, and he wanted to stay with his family. He wanted to, mm-hmm. you know, we had to beg him to become Speaker of the House. So this debauchery of him being the Speaker of the House, dealing with the Trump administration, is a plate that was served to him in his decision to become the Speaker of the House. So I personally think...
Okay, Robert?
Yeah?
Your one-sentence question.
What's the question?
What is your question? Your one-sentence question.
Okay, great. That's a great question to ask me. Why did he accept the position of Speaker of the House at the time he did?
Actually, you know what? The question that you actually told the screeners was better, which is, are you disappointed now in your decision to become Speaker of the House? Which is really a fascinating question. I don't know what he would say publicly, but now you do realize why he was so reluctant. You also realize why nobody else wants this job, because you know what the Speaker of the House really involves, what the job is? It is herding cats. And you're seeing how difficult that would be. So I don't know, but I'm guessing that he goes home on a regular basis, and his wife looks at him and says, "What were you thinking back then? How did you think that was going to play out?" No, that really is an excellent question. Okay, let's again. I'm looking for the one sentence the question. Let's go to Rick from is it Chatham? Chatham, Massachusetts. You're on Indivisible. Good evening.
Yes. Good evening. How are you tonight?
Good.
My question is this, and let me just give a quick preface, then I'll go right to the question.
But no, go right to the question.
Yeah. Okay. How does hollowing out essential benefits on health plans for lower incomes, small businesses, and individuals, while reducing taxes on the very wealthy, build an engaged citizenry?
An engaged citizenry. Okay, now tell me what your preface would have been to that question.
My preface to the question is that the... a lot of the figures have been showing since 2000 that the incomes and the opportunity for lower-income people is going down. And there's been a lot of conjecture about it. There's been a lot of hypothesis about it. But it is what it is. And a lot of the costs for these people have increased. Their incomes have gone down. Their kids have joined the military for opportunity. Their other kids have gone into deep debt mm-hmm. with student loans. It looks like our lower classes are, and I, we're all from there. We're all part of America.
So basically, I know that Republicans accuse the left of engaging in class warfare. You're suggesting that it's Republicans who are engaging in class warfare.
Oh, yeah. I think they're beating up on the lower classes. And I don't understand why, because I think what history has shown is that
You know what? This is a question that I'm very likely to ask him, because this really goes to the heart of the debate that they're in right now. okay, you are a compassionate conservative, would say to him, and you are cutting benefits for the poor, cutting taxes for the rich. Why do you think this is sound public policy? I think that's a fair question. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. James from Cincinnati, Ohio, you are an indivisible. Good evening. What one question would you ask Speaker Paul Ryan?
My one question is, whether it be Democrat, Republican, hard left, hard right, whoever, when are we going to fix the problem in this country of underpay, underinsured, people losing their jobs every day? The unemployment rate, of course, is very low, but people, the good-paying jobs are gone, and the insurance keeps rising. Those are facts, and I would just like to hear someone from Washington give me an answer.
All right. Now, fair enough. Now, James, could you just, if you're uncomfortable, you don't have to answer the question. Who did you vote for in the presidential election?
I voted for Hillary.
Okay. All right. Thanks for the call. By the way, all these questions are exactly the kind of question that I am looking for. This is a call from back home from Paul Ryan's district in my home state of Wisconsin. Eric from Kenosha, Wisconsin. You're on Indivisible. Good evening. How are you?
Hi, I'm good, thanks. My one question to Paul Ryan would be, given the dollar amounts have been cut from things like the Great Lakes programs to keep the Great Lakes clean and protected, particularly Lake Michigan, which abuts his home district, cuts to the National Park District, cuts to the NEA, given those dollar amounts, while significant to those programs, are such a tiny portion of the overall federal budget, what benefit to the country is there by making those cuts relative to the harm that I think could be very real relative to the Great Lakes, the national parks, et cetera?
Fair enough. Just the clarification, those cuts have been proposed in the Trump budget, but they have not been enacted. They have not actually, the funds haven't been getting, but fair enough. No, fair enough, because the cuts to, for example, the Great Lakes, that's a big issue, obviously, in a state like Wisconsin. Our phone number, 844-745-TALK, 844-745-8255. Let's go right in our own backyard here. Liz from Manhattan, you're on Indivisible. Good evening.
Thanks for taking my call. The VA is a mess, and opioid addiction is a national crisis. What will Congress do about our veterans who can't get health care and are addicted to opioids as a result of the injuries they received in service to their country? And by way of context, I got a family member who,
That is an excellent question. This is one of those issues, and maybe I'm giving away my cynicism, where I hear the politicians talk about this, but I'm not sure that I've actually heard a solution that deals with something, with the magnitude of this problem.
Well, in fairness, I never thought I'd say this, and I certainly didn't think I would say this on the air, but I am a screaming liberal who, moved to another state to campaign for Hillary Clinton, and I reached out to my family member's congressman, who is a very conservative Republican, and shout out to Congressman Rozier, who, like his staff, has been helpful and responsive and compassionate, and I appreciate that. But a person shouldn't have to reach out to their elected official in order to get the health care that they deserve by virtue of having served their country. That should just be forthcoming from the system that is designed to protect the people who have protected us.
Liz, thanks so much for the call. I appreciate it very much. And well put, by the way. Adam from Piscataway, New Jersey, you are an indivisible.
My one question is, how does Paul Ryan intend to combat the perception that the GOP has been making cuts that benefit the very wealthy, especially with the advent of Trump? And how does that affect things?
Well, that is an interesting point. One of the things I'm hoping to have the time to get into with Paul Ryan is, Paul Ryan had represented a very different, much more, I would say, compassionate face of conservatism. You're asking, given the optics, how is this working out at the moment? Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. We're keeping. Believe it or not, we are actually keeping track of all of these questions. Let's go up to New Hampshire. Howard from Sugar Hill, New Hampshire. Welcome to Indivisible. Good evening. What one question would you ask Speaker Paul Ryan?
I would like to ask Speaker Ryan how he can defend the cuts to NIH and also the devastating cuts to Meals on Wheels.
You know, I actually spent some time trying to figure out how deep the cuts to Meals on Wheels was. I was not able to actually determine it, but I will. Yes, those are good questions. I think a lot of people. We've had multiple questions on that particular issue. 844-745-TALK, 844-745-8255. Let's go up to Cambridge, Massachusetts. I'm going to be there in a couple of weeks. Evan from Cambridge, you're on Indivisible. What would you ask Speaker Paul Ryan?
I would ask him specifically, what can you and what will you do to decrease partisanship in the country and Washington, D.C.?
That's a great question. I don't know if anybody has any answer. And what I love talking to politicians, they will always talk about how they want to do that, but then they don't. So actually, one of the questions I do have down on my own list is earlier this week, he said he did not want to see President Trump cut a deal with the Democrats on Obamacare. So he's already suggested that he did not want to see that sort of thing. Well, so we'll see where they're going on all of that. Jill from Los Angeles, California. Thanks for joining us. What would you ask Speaker Paul Ryan?
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I'd like to know if there's any hope of impeachment of this unqualified man, and if not, why not?
What would you impeach him for?
She told me to keep it brief.
Yeah.
So
let's start with what you told the screener about the investigations into Russia.
Exactly.
Is that what you're concerned about?
I'm concerned about everything, but, you know, that seems to be the most impeachable offense at this point, if it's proven to be true.
Yeah, that's of course, the issue is that we're living in an era of bipartisan leaks. Every single day you get a leak on one side or a leak on the other side. I'm in the position of I want to know what the truth is. I really do want to know what the truth is, and I would like to have the truth determined by somebody that is, in fact, trustworthy, and at the moment I'm not sure who that is. I'm not sure. I do think the Senate is doing a reasonably good job doing that, but I don't know. Okay, let's go to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Kish, you are on Indivisible. What would you ask Speaker Paul Ryan?
Hi, I'd like to know how giving a tax cut to the CEOs of health insurance companies will help our supposedly tanking Obamacare.
What would you like to see done with Obamacare?
Well, definitely not give tax cuts to the CEOs that make over $200,000. But yeah, I'd like to see it be more affordable, and I'd like to see the poor get more of a tax break, so they can invest it in health care. I know they get credits and stuff like that, but there's so many things wrong with this proposal that to cut hospitalizations and mental health care and all that. I mean, it's just insane what the conservatives are proposing. But I'm just baffled by how can a tax cut to the CEOs that make over $250,000, how is that going to help the deficit they're already crying about with this health care plan?
Kish, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. I guess that is all the calls that we have time for. That went really fast, didn't it? When we come back from the break, we'll be talking live with Speaker Paul Ryan. You're listening to Indivisible, Public Radio's national conversation about America in a time of change. Stay with us.
Indivisible is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes, pre-selected portions, and fresh ingredients to customers' doors. More at blueapron.com/indivisible.
This is Indivisible, Public Radio's national conversation about America in a time of change.
This is Charlie Sykes from WNYC Studios in New York, and I want to welcome back my friend, Speaker Paul Ryan, Indivisible.
Charlie.
Good evening.
Are you doing this in New York City?
We are not in Kansas or Wisconsin anymore.
Good grief. This is like an out-of-body experience. It's nice to talk to you again.
It is great to talk with you. So let's just get right, by the way, this is a different world we're in here since the last time you and I talked.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Yeah.
So the word on Twitter, where I get all my news these days, say that you were at the White House tonight. Are we going to get health care this spring? And if not, is it dead?
Well, no, it's not dead. It's alive, and we're making progress. We've gotten some reforms that we've agreed to, and we're working on some others. So we're making good steps in the right direction. We've got a number of concepts that our members are working toward to improve the bill. It's all about how do you bring down premiums even more. And so we've got some ideas we've already agreed to, and we're working on some others, which will take a little bit of time, just getting the analysis and getting language drafted and further negotiations. But we're making progress.
Okay. Well, the polls would suggest that this bill had a 17% approval rating.
Everybody likes to say that.
But that was before there were reports that Republicans might water down protections for people with pre-existing conditions, grant state waivers on the so-called community rating, which allows insurance companies to charge sick people more. So, you know, right now, are you losing the public relations war? Whatever's going on inside of Washington, have you convinced the American public that you have the right idea?
Well, I think the American public who experiences Obamacare does not like Obamacare because it is a collapsing system with skyrocketing price increases, massive deductibles. And the insurers are telling us it's going to get even worse next year. If you're not on Obamacare and you just think of it as just generally health care, then you know you don't know what to think. The Democratic half of this country, let's just for the sake of argument say we're 50-50 country, the Democrats don't like any move to repeal Obamacare. So that's a lot of people right there who don't like what we're doing. And then there's been a debate among Republicans about how best to go about doing this. What's frustrating for us in the House and for many of our members is the only way we can do this is to use the Senate's procedures. It's called reconciliation. It's a budget bill. It's the only way to avoid a filibuster. The problem is we cannot put all of the reforms that we really believe and that we like as conservatives, which are create more patient-centered system, we can't put all of those reforms in a Senate budget bill because their rules prohibit that. So it's that confusion surrounding this bill that drives that. But when you take a look at our entire effort, it's three-pronged approach. One is this bill, which cannot be filibustered in the Senate. Then it's all the deregulation that the HHS Secretary Tom Price can do to bring market stabilization, bring down prices even further. And then third, those other bills that we believe in that will lower health care costs that have to go through the filibuster, medical liability reform, let people buy insurance across state lines, let people buy, small businesses buy insurance in nationwide buying pools through their trade associations. Those are things that we would love to put in this bill, but the Senate rules prohibit us from doing that. And it's that confusion that kind of has people, you know, confused.
Well, the reports this week were that in order to get this thing through, you might actually, again, water down the protections that have been built in for people with pre-existing conditions. So if somebody is listening to us right now, you know, from Minnesota or California, you know, are you going to take away that guaranteed issue?
There's a commitment. There's a solid commitment in our Congress to safeguard pre-existing conditions. It is all about how do we get prices down while we make sure that people with pre-existing conditions are still covered, are still protected. But it's all about what are the better ideas. Risk sharing and risk pools is something that we've been talking quite a bit about, which, you know, if you remember, we had a good one in Wisconsin. We had a good high-risk pool in Wisconsin where people with pre-existing conditions could get affordable coverage. They didn't go bankrupt when they got sick. And what it ended up doing is it made insurance cheaper for everybody else because the risk pool covered those with catastrophic illnesses so that the rest of the insurance pool did not necessarily have to do that. Those are the kinds of ideas we're talking about, which is how do I have our cake and eat it too? How to make sure that everybody, regardless of their health condition, can get affordable coverage, but that we can lower the price of coverage for average folks, which is not what Obamacare is doing. Remember, Obama himself said it's going to lower your premiums by $2,500. It did the exact opposite of that. Remember, he said you're going to have the plan you want to choose from. a third of all counties in America only have one plan to choose
okay,
from.
So, when will we see a bill?
Well, we're working on that. I don't want to put a timeline on it, only that we want to get this right. We've made some improvements already. We've got some things that have been agreed to, but not all of it has been agreed to. So we're still working on that, and it's going to take some time. So that's why we're taking the relevant amount of time to get it right, to write it correctly, and to get the consensus. We're very, very close in our conference. 90% of our conference was already there. 10% was not.
Okay.
So we're having the kinds of productive mm-hmm. conversations between House Republicans and the White House and other experts that were consulting.
By the end of April?
I'm not going to put a date on it, but yes, we're moving as quickly as we can. And we obviously anticipate doing that this spring, but I'm not going to put a specific date on it because I don't want to put an artificial deadline on what is really promising good work that's occurring.
Okay. I want to share with you some of the questions that we got from the audience and give you a chance, you know, tee them up so you can respond briefly to them. You know, our first caller out of Massachusetts wanted me to ask you, how does cutting benefits for the poor and cutting taxes for the rich, how is that sound public policy?
Well,
and that's the way, of course, a lot of people look at what you're doing with Obamacare, that you have this massive tax cut, and many people will, in fact, lose their health insurance. How do you respond to that?
Well, I'd say a couple of things. Number one, we're repealing all of the Obamacare taxes. It's a pledge we made, and also we think the Obamacare system is collapsing and failing, and we want to replace it with something that will actually work, that's going to be better health care with better, lower prices and more choices. We believe in a patient-centered system. That means choice and competition in health care. You don't have one insurer to choose from, but many insurers to choose from, so they compete against each other for our business. With respect to health care for the poor, I assume that that's referring to Medicaid.
Yes. Well,
Medicaid is not working in many states. Many doctors don't even take Medicaid anymore, so it's a system that is in dire need of reform. And what's very interesting when you look at this situation is every state's different. The health care system, the hospital systems, the insurance system, and the condition of the poor in the states vary from state to state.
Will
state,
poor
community,
people
community.
Will poor people lose health coverage as
no,
a result of your
no,
legislation?
No, we believe this will lead to better health care coverage for the poor, because what we want to do is give the states the ability to make better changes for health care for their populations. You know, in Wisconsin, that we wanted to do more reforms to Healthy Wisconsin, to our Medicaid program, but because of the federal government, we can't have better reforms to make it work better, to make it so that doctors want to take Medicaid patients. So by giving the states control of the Medicaid population, by giving them states control of Medicaid itself, they can do more innovative things to make it actually work for their state instead of going through this cookie-cutter, one-size-fits-all, top-down Washington micromanagement.
But do you understand how that line works, that here's legislation, the first thing out of the box, you know, after an election in which we talked about the need, you know, to help the average working person and the incredible, you know, disparities of wealth, where you are having a big tax cut for the wealthy, and there will be cuts in benefits to lower income people, leaving aside, you know, the other things, do the rich need a tax cut right now?
The one tax increase that we delayed in Obamacare is actually the tax on high wage earners, the Medicare payroll tax on high wage earners. That's the one thing we actually delay for many years to finance more programs for Medicaid. So the other point I'd say is we're going to, after we're done with health care, focus on tax reform, which is reform the entire tax code. So with respect to the taxes itself, there are a lot of onerous Obamacare taxes that are making healthcare more expensive, making medical devices more expensive, that are not working, that are making it harder for people to get affordable coverage and devices. So we're going to get rid of these Obamacare taxes because we think they're bad for the economy and bad for healthcare.
Okay.
But then we're going to go reform the entire U.S. tax code. Mm-hmm. So the story on tax policy is not yet written to its fullest extent, because we've got to reform our entire tax system so we get faster economic growth. Our goal in tax policy is not to sit around and decide, you know, how to redistribute people's money. Our goal in tax policy is to get the American tax system whipped into shape so we can keep jobs in America.
Okay. Let me now, you have to understand, I'm, you know, broadcasting here from public radio in New York, so I'm surrounded by people who ask me questions like this. For example, why does Paul Ryan have so much contempt for poor people? I kid you not, so I thought I would give you
that
question.
All right, I just took a sip of water. That was pretty good.
Jessica from Yonkers wants to know, why does Paul Ryan hate poor people?
let me just say this. I don't. I just don't believe that more government, more spending, more top-down bureaucratic micromanagement from Washington is the way to save people from poverty. If you actually take a look at my record and what we actually proposed as House Republicans, we think we have much better ideas for going at the root cause of poverty, fight poverty and its root causes, and help break the cycle of poverty. We have a plan for upward mobility and fighting poverty that we think will work. We are now in the 52nd year of the war on poverty. Trillions were spent, and yet the poverty rate is about the same as it was when we started this. It's a stalemate. So this idea of measuring success in fighting poverty based on how much money we spend or how many rules and programs come out of Washington is a ridiculous notion that doesn't work because we're not measuring the right thing. We should be measuring whether our reforms actually get people out of poverty, actually create wealth and opportunity and upward mobility so people can get out of poverty. Mm-hmm. Those are the kinds of reforms we're talking about. How do you do reforms to help local communities, help poverty fighters, to get people out of the cycle of poverty? And I would strongly argue that we have a lot of federal programs that make it harder for people to get out of poverty, that are trapping people in poverty, that are disincentivizing work and upward mobility. And so we have a long, wide variety of ideas and reforms that we're moving through Congress that we're proposing.
All right. Let me ask you this other question that's coming up over and over and over again about your relationship now with Donald Trump, as, of course, you had been very outspoken during the campaign. Let me ask you this directly. A lot of people say, so has Paul Ryan made kind of a Faustian bargain to overlook the things that Trump says about, you know, women, the textbook cases of racism, that you've made this calculation that you can't break with him or criticize him because it's more important for him to sign your legislation so that basically you've had to swallow a lot in order to get your agenda passed. Is that the way you conceive it?
Charlie, I represent the legislative branch of government as the Speaker of the House. Donald Trump just got duly elected President of the United States. I think the American people want to see their government work. And it is my job as head of the legislative branch to do everything I can to help make the executive branch work well. I want to see Donald Trump succeed, because if Donald Trump succeeds as president, America succeeds as a country.
Will you criticize him if you think he crosses
the
line?
Sure, of course. Remember when he talked about torture, I said, I think in the press conference, you know, hours later, we're not going to change the laws surrounding torture. So clearly, mm-hmm. if I see things that I don't agree with, I'll say so. But what I want to do is make him successful so that America succeeds. And I also believe that means tackling an agenda mm-hmm. that addresses people's problems and improves people's lives.
Okay. Earlier today, the president had an interview with the New York Times where he made a number of comments, including that people thought that Susan Rice might have committed some crimes. But he also said that Fox News host Bill O'Reilly did nothing wrong in his treatment of women. And, of course, we know that he's paid out about $13 million in treatment. So the president of the United States, the leader of your party, says Bill O'Reilly did nothing wrong. Paul Ryan, do you agree
really
with him?
I don't know what you're talking about. I'm not very familiar with what Bill O'Reilly. I think I remember hearing a few years ago he did some phone conversation, but I can't speak to that. I don't even know what the heck you're talking about, Charlie.
Well, you're talking about the New York Times story that documented all of the cases of sexual harassment. And
please don't take offense to this, no. But I don't read the New York Times all that often, and I'm just not familiar with the story.
You know, I've described myself...
Okay.
I've described myself in the past as a Ryan conservative, and I remember last year, it was really...
You and I talked about this a lot last
year.
Yeah,
no, we did. I mean, there were two very distinct brands of conservatism. You know, Ryanism was for free trade, open immigration reform, was aspirational, it was inclusive. Very, very clear contrast to Donald Trump. So I guess my question to you today is, is there still a distinctively Ryan brand of conservatism, or have you folded into the Trump agenda?
No, I think what we're trying to do is make both work together. I think what we're trying to do is make these things work together. We have agreed on a common agenda that we're going to work on. We have agreed, first of all, you said open immigration. That doesn't mean open borders. That means securing the border. I've always been for securing the border, and I know you know that. But it also talks about upward mobility, welfare reform. It talks about tax reform, patient-centered health care reform. The kind of entitlement reform we're getting with this health care bill is the biggest entitlement reform we've ever had. That's stuff I've been talking about for years, and you know that. And so what we have before us is an agreement that we're going to be tackling these tough issues together. Are we different kinds of Republicans and conservatives? Absolutely. You know that.
Yeah.
But we have an obligation to work together for the good of the country.
So
we have an obligation to try and make this work so we can advance our common goals and principles. And that's
so Twitter, the president's Twitter account, making your life easier or harder?
I actually don't read it. I am made aware of some of them every now and then. It depends on the tweet. Ask me on a tweet-by-tweet basis.
It's kind of a Paul, yes, a Paul Ryan bubble. No. You have staffers who keep you from reading things.
As a general rule now, I don't go on Twitter.
we had a bunch of questions about the budget, the proposed budget, including the one me to ask you. So how do you defend cutting money to the NIH, cutting Meals on Wheels, cutting programs for the national parks and the Great Lakes? I haven't heard what your comments were about the president's budget cuts.
Yeah, I actually support the NIH. I helped broker the agreement to do what we call the Cures Act, which was an agreement to increase NIH funding because we cut spending in other areas for that. So I'm a big fan of the NIH. That's a specific point I'll make. Mm-hmm. But the budget they sent us is a budget that we're going to look at and process, and Congress will do its own work on the budget. So this is just the beginning of the process. There are clearly domestic discretionary spending programs that I think are wasteful, duplicative, bloated, that need to be cut. So you know me, I'm a budget hawk. I think there are a lot of things that should be cut back. I think there are a lot of reforms that are desperately needed. But I also think we need to focus on what we call mandatory spending. And that's an area where I think we need to find
the entitlement
savings.
Programs.
Yeah, the entitlement. That's where I think we need to find spending for things like the military and the rest. So what happens in the new presidency, of any new president, is they don't give you a complete budget up front because they don't have the time to assemble one. So what we saw is what they call it the skinny budget. We just saw mm-hmm. a piece of their budget, and they didn't want to show an increase in the military that's not being offset. But they haven't shown the rest of their budget. And Congress will take all of it under consideration and proceed with our budget. We do believe there's a real problem with our military. It's been hollowed out. It needs to be rebuilt. But we've got to pay for that spending. And so this is one way of paying for the spending that they've suggested. Congress is going to look at a whole bunch of different ways so that at the end of the day, we're paying for the spending.
I wish we had more time. But Speaker Ryan, I want to thank you so much for joining me again on the radio.
You know, it's been nice. You're sitting in New York doing this now, aren't you?
I am.
Wow, I just never thought I'd talk to Charlie Sykes sitting in New York doing a radio show.
I never thought I'd be talking to Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House of Representatives. So,
so
we are even. Thanks so much, Paul.
Right,
I appreciate
it. You bet, Charlie. Take care.
So that's all for tonight. That went fast. Tomorrow night, host Kerry Miller of Minnesota Public Radio will talk about the idea of the American dream, if we all share the same idea of what it is and how that affects our democracy. I also want to let you know about a project that we're doing here at Indivisible. We are partnering with StoryCorps on something that will hopefully help us get out of our bubbles, at least a little bit. So we're asking you to sign up to interview somebody in your own life with whom you disagree with politically and with whom you're on speaking terms. If you'd like your pitch, StoryCorps will help you produce, will produce the interview, and you'll come on the air to talk about it. You may have somebody in mind that you want to interview. You may want us to partner with you, hook you up with somebody. Either way, email us at StoryCorps.net with the subject line Indivisible Interview. Tell us who you want to interview and why. I'm Charlie Sykes, and I'm guessing I'll be back next Wednesday.
Support for Indivisible is provided in part by Emerson Collective, the Ford Foundation, and the Jacob and Valeria Langloth Foundation.
If you like the Indivisible podcast, rate and review it and tell your friends. And thanks for listening.